Okay, let's start. This is part of a chapter on the social and political theory of the 20th and 21st centuries. And today, I'm going to talk about Michel Foucault. Foucault is a French historian of ideas. He was born in 1926 in the city of Poitiers in France, middle of France, and his family occupied a considerable social position. His father, Paul Foucault, was a reputed surgeon who also wanted to send Michel on the path of medicine. But the young boy, however, showed little interest in scientific subjects at school. He was much more interested in history, French, Latin, and Greek. So by the middle of the Second World War, 17-year-old Foucault completed his secondary school at a high school, a lycée in Poitiers. The city was then located in the part of France occupied by Nazi Germany, so-called Vichy France, the regime of Vichy. The focus of the schoolboy Foucault was on philosophy and history. He worked uninterruptedly and he barely allowed himself some time to rest. Still, his efforts were not enough. He did not pass the entrance exam to the highly selective École Normale Supérieure, that's the ENS in Paris. It's a school, you cannot really compare it to anything else in other countries. It started out as a school for teachers, and then it gradually became this, it's like an equivalent to university, but it has, it's difficult to explain actually. You should do some research of yourself on this, on the École Normale Supérieure. Suffice to say that it's for the humanities, for the social sciences, for literature, literary history, for philosophy, it's one of the top schools in France, if not in the world. And much of that has to do with its very strict selection of students in the entrance exam. So Foucault did not make it, and he was actually only 100 new students were allowed, and he was number 101. So he just failed entering the school. He was undeterred, however. He continued his studies at another school in Paris, again a lycée, as a preparation in order to retake the exam. He did so and finally passed it in 1946. Then his time as a student at the ENS was an eventful period in the life of the young man. Again, he worked very hard. He was considered to be an outsider among his fellow students, and he even became depressed because of social isolation. That depression led to a first suicide attempt. What may have played a role in Foucault's psychological difficulties were the psychic difficulties he experienced with his emerging homosexuality, which was then still quite taboo in France. So by 1951, he obtained his aggregation diploma. He did quite long over his studies. Other fellow students did it much faster. The student Foucault underwent various influences, and it's worthwhile to talk about those influences for a few moments. In addition to philosophy, he became passionate about psychology as well. At the Sorbonne, he succeeded even while studying at the ENS. So he studied both at the ENS and at the Sorbonne, the French university in Paris, at the same time. And at the Sorbonne, he succeeded for an additional degree in the field of psychology. One of his professors there was the French philosopher Maurice Merleau-Ponty. During his studies, Foucault also developed a political awareness. One of his teachers, one of his favorite teachers at the ENS, was Louis Althusser. Althusser was a Marxist philosopher who would become highly influential as a political thinker during the 1960s. And discussions between Foucault and Althusser caused the young Foucault to come closer to the French Communist Party. However, in the end, he did decide not to become a party member. He would still remain firmly on the left side of the political spectrum, you could say, for the rest of his life. Remarkably absent in the list of influences on Foucault's thought is the celebrated philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre. Still, Sartre and Foucault shared a number of ideas, such as their shared admiration for the writer novelist, theatre author Jean Genet. Still, Sartre's emphasis on the individual did not sufficiently take into account the impact of social structures, according to Foucault. And the young historian, Foucault, would increasingly devote his attention to these social structures. In the early 1950s, he lectured in psychology at the ENS for a short period. He did so at the invitation of Althusser. And during the same period, he did a number of internships as a psychologist in various psychiatric institutions and in prisons. Later, he enjoyed a doctoral scholarship for a few years and also received grants to study in Sweden, in Poland, and in West Germany. Germany was still divided at that time. The research he conducted during the early phase of his career led to two dissertations, as was expected of him in France. It earned him the degree of doctor in 1961. Especially the second of his two dissertations made an impression on the jury. That was his study of the historical evolution of the concept of madness during the early modern period. We're talking specifically about the 18th century now. His thesis, his dissertation, became the basis for his famous book Histoire de la folie à l'âge classique, which was first published in English, under the title Madness and Civilization, A History of Insanity in the Age of Reason, 1964. In the year 1966, that book was followed by another book with a more philosophical outlook, which became at least equally famous. More than that, it can be seen as the methodological program for Foucault's entire career, you could say. That book was Les mots et les choses, une archéologie des sciences humaines, translated in English as The Order of Things, an Archaeology of the Human Sciences. Later in this session, I will zoom in on the introduction to that book, in which Foucault analyzes a famous painting. It might seem surprising at first why the author of a book on the human sciences, such as history, economy, psychology, chooses to focus on the work of art, but hopefully that will become clear in a few moments. Now, the main line of Foucault's book was that the concepts of the human sciences, such as crime, such as poverty, such as mental illness, are not objective concepts that are established once and for all and that can be measured in an objective way, such as is done in physics or in other natural sciences. On the contrary, these concepts from the humanities, are as much subject to historical evolution as political institutions or scientific theories. That is why an archaeology of the humanities and the social sciences was highly needed. I place the word archaeology in brackets here, between quotes, I mean, because, of course, you're not digging up artifacts, but you're digging up concepts, you're digging up the history of concepts. That's what Foucault aiming to do. This kind of research project by Foucault could reveal what had been possible to count as true within a specific historical period. That's what he sets out to do. Now let me continue his biographical sketch because it's quite important to understand. The life of Foucault is quite important to understand the work of Foucault, I believe. In the course of the 1960s, Foucault lectured at various universities in France and abroad. He worked at the University of Clermont-Ferrand in France, at the University of Tunis in Tunisia, and at the University of Paris 8, which is located in Vincennes, close to Paris. In 1970, he was nominated for a chair at the Collège de France, which is the highest academic distinction that he could be awarded in his own country. On his request, the chair was named History of Systems of Thought. Now, the word systems did not turn up by coincidence here. Neither was the fact that Foucault's colleagues at the Collège de France included thinkers such as Roland Barthes and Claude Lévi-Strauss. During the 1970s, and to a certain extent also in the subsequent decade, structuralism was very prominent in French intellectual life. Although Foucault, Barthes and Lévi-Strauss were three very different thinkers, they do share a common interest in the structures that determine human society. Such structures or systems were to be found in the social field, but also in human languages or in conceptual systems. All three of these leading thinkers were deeply convinced of the contingent nature of those structures. And here contingency, to be contingent, means the insight that although something might be the case today, it could still have been very different under different historical circumstances. Things are as they are now, but they could have been otherwise. That's the insight into a contingency. Today, for instance, we are familiar with certain forms of organizing families. Think of the concept of the nuclear family. The nuclear family consists of two parents with one or more children. Or we are familiar with certain intellectual concepts and familiar with certain visual codes. But all that has been very different at other places and in other times. That is the insight of contingency. Claude Lévi-Strauss, for instance, had demonstrated that such intellectual concepts occurred in highly divergent forms. And he illustrated this with numerous examples from social and cultural anthropology. Foucault now showed, among other things, how the medieval way of dealing with mental illness was completely different from that of the 18th century, and again different from the way we're dealing with it today. During his work at the Collège de France, Foucault every year gave 12 highly popular lectures. In addition, he was leading a research seminar. So these duties are very minimal from an academic point of view, and it allowed him to travel, to give lectures abroad, to conduct new research, and to fulfill his social obligations. In this respect, too, the historian Foucault had a solid reputation as a committed public intellectual. He was, among other things, active in the Groupe d'Information sur les Prisons, which translates as the Information Group on Prisons. That organization was formed in 1971 to investigate the living conditions in French prisons. Members of the group, such as Foucault, smuggled surveys into penitentiary institutions, to which access was denied for journalists at that time in France. The resulting information, so the insights they gained, the group gained, through these surveys, eventually led to radical reforms of the French prison system. Furthermore, Foucault stood up for human rights. He committed himself in particular to defending the rights of political activists. He protested, for instance, against expressions of racism in France. In 1978, he traveled to Iran in order to meet the leaders of the Islamist protest against the pro-Western regime of Mohammad Reza Shah Pahlavi. His enthusiastic support for the Iranian insurgents made him the target of criticism in the West, since it was seen as an endorsement to the strictly religious policy of Ayatollah Khomeini. And even today still, the way in which Foucault took position in the conflict between the West and Iran is still highly controversial and much debated. During the 1980s, Foucault enjoyed various appointments as a researcher and a visiting professor to various American universities. In the gay scene of California, where he worked for a while, he could, moreover, openly express his homosexuality. By 1984, he was back in Paris. In February, he gave the first lecture of what would be his last series of lectures at the Collège de France. In the course during this class, he again discussed the structures that determine the conditions under which a given speech act can be called true. But he also linked that topic to the death of Socrates. That the Greek philosopher Socrates chose death rather than to betray his essential mission was seen by Foucault as a choice for the protection of courageous truth-speaking. At the end of March, Foucault closed his last lecture with the words, "There you are. Listen, I have things to say to you about the general framework of these analyses, but, well, it is too late now. So, thank you." And those were, end of quote, and those were his last words in public. At the beginning of June, he was admitted to the Hôpital de la Salpêtrière, a famous Paris hospital, which he had studied very intensely during the earliest stage of his career. Foucault's body at that time showed symptoms of a severely weakened immune system. On the 9th of June, Foucault died of the consequences of AIDS. Good, that was my brief biographical sketch of Foucault. Now, Let's go over to his so-called archaeology of the human sciences. First, let me focus on the general outlook of Foucault's social theory. That's what I want to do. And in order to get a good look at his at the framework of his ideas, it's a good idea to look at his programmatic book from 1961, which I already mentioned, which was called Les Mots et les Choses, The Order of Things. Foucault's book opens with an interesting perspective. The reader expects a philosophical argument, but instead you get an analysis of the famous painting Las Meninas, The Ladies in Waiting, by Diego Velázquez. You will know this famous painting. It's from 1656. And the central role in the painting, you will see it before you, is for the five-year-old Infanta, Margarita Teresa. She's the eldest daughter of King Philip IV of Spain. And she's flanked by her ladies-in-waiting. This is the Las Meninas. These are the Las Meninas of the title of the painting. And, moreover, by two dwarfs. But the most remarkable element in the painting is that the point where the viewer is standing is integrated into the painting. To the left of the Infante, in a prominent place of the picture, we see the painter himself, Velázquez, who is looking in the direction of the viewer. Even a piece of the back of the canvas he is painting is visible. And another element where we see that the viewer is integrated is the mirror. There is a mirror integrated in the painting on the back wall of the room that is depicted in the painting. And in that mirror, two small figures are depicted, a man and a woman. They can be identified as King Philip IV and Queen Mariana, the parents of Margarita Teresa, of the young princess. The most common assumption is that the reflection shows the couple in the pose they are holding for Velázquez as he paints them, while their daughter is watching them. Foucault interprets Las Meninas as a representation of a representation. What does he precisely mean by this? He means that Velázquez, as a court painter, was very familiar with how this kind of painting, the portrait, functioned as a form of representation. Princess Margarita Teresa, for instance, was portrayed several times by Velázquez with the intention of giving her future husband, the Roman-German Emperor Leopold I, an image of his bride in the making as she was growing up. What Velázquez is doing in this painting is providing a commentary to that form of representation. So, in effect, what the viewer sees is a representation of a representation. By including himself very prominently in the picture, Velázquez tells us something about the creation of such a portrait. We not only get to see an artwork, but we get to see an artwork about an artwork. It is as if the engine room of courtly art, so to speak, is briefly opened to us. Velázquez shows the conventions and the limitations of a portrait of a princess while making a portrait of a princess. It's a meta painting, it's a meta work of art. It is exactly the same kind of exercise that Foucault wants to do at the level of the human sciences. Every historian, every anthropologist or sociologist operates within a certain horizon, Foucault believes. This is something which he or she is seldom aware of. Foucault calls it the episteme of a scientific discipline. He's referring to the Greek word episteme here. Episteme means knowledge, truthful knowledge in Greek. So the episteme comprises the conditions that determine what can be recognized as truthful statements within a certain period and concerning a certain subject. The episteme is a set of inescapable, often unconscious, and always anonymous forms of thought. The episteme defines a field of knowledge within the whole of human experience. It determines how objects appear in that field, and it determines the conditions on the basis of which a discourse can be recognized as true. Okay, let's zoom in on one particular human science, namely psychiatry. It's a discipline that would occupy Foucault intensely during the first phase of his career, leading to his famous book, Madness and Civilization. Central to the science of psychiatry is the concept of mental illness, or madness, or folie in French. It's what we call mental illness today, but before it was called madness. To indicate the relative nature of this concept, Foucault quotes the Russian writer Fyodor Dostoevsky. And I quote, "It is not by locking up one's neighbor that one convinces oneself of one's own sanity." End of quote. Foucault shows that madness is a cultural construction. The concept of madness underwent significant changes in the history of civilization. Those different understandings of insanity correspond with how the treatment of the mentally ill drastically changed during the course of history. In the Middle Ages, for instance, the insane were those who had to be excluded from society. A symbolic picture of how the mentally ill were treated was the so-called Ship of Fools. You've probably seen depictions of this. The Ship of Fools is a topic that returned in medieval art and early modern art quite a lot. And if you look at images of this, you will see a ship full of deranged individuals, which referred to those who were seen as deviant. Either they were physically deviant, physically disabled, for instance, or mentally disabled, mentally deranged, mentally ill. And they were banished from the community. That's what the Ship of Fools is doing. The ship is taking people away from the city, away from the mainland, and putting them elsewhere in an island in a kind of banishment. Foucault also refers to stories of how mentally ill persons were flogged in public and then, as a kind of game, chased out of the city during a staged hunt. What you can learn from this, Foucault says, is that madness for the medieval mind stood apart from life. It was not integrated into life. And because of that special status, the madman could also be transformed into something totally different, something more positive. Think, for instance, of the figure of the fool. Precisely because the fool deviates from normalcy, he has a privileged access to the truth. A good example, for instance, is the character of the fool in Shakespeare's play King Lear. Think of King Lear. King Lear is this elderly king who wants to divide his kingdom among his daughters, but he still wants to retain some of his power and part of his army. It turns out to be a terribly bad idea, and he makes a number of bad choices, and the fool is the only one who is allowed to say so, who can explicitly say that the king is making bad choices. He has privileges. During the 18th century now, so after the Middle Ages, in the early modern period, in the 18th century specifically, a new way of dealing with the mentally ill was slowly introduced. The meaning of the word madness itself consequently changed. That new treatment of the mentally ill no longer consisted in excluding the mentally ill. They were no longer banished from the community, but rather they were included, not excluded, but included. They were locked up in asylums and institutions. The insane were placed under supervision, subjected to the discipline of an institution, and later also medicalized. So madness was no longer seen as the special condition which this kind of strange social status which made it necessary to expel you from the society. It was recognized more and more often as a medical condition, something which had to be treated. And the first step of that treatment was locking you up, keeping your madness contained within an institution. This led to an extensive institutional system of madness coming into being. It would eventually lead to the emergence of psychiatry, but then we're already talking about the 19th century, not the 18th century. And that emerging discipline of psychiatry would have its own institutions, such as the psychiatric hospital. It would have its own professions, such as the psychiatrist, neurologist, the psychotherapist, the psychiatric nurse, and its own jargon, the term madness fell into disuse, and instead a new term took its place, mental illness or mental disorder. This development has led to the medical discipline of psychiatry as we know it today. In the current system, Foucault writes, the patient has become completely isolated from the world. Communication between the insane and the outside world, between the mentally ill and the normal, so-called normal people, is no longer deemed possible. Let me quote Foucault on this. On the one hand, the man of reason delegates the physician to madness, thereby authorizing a relation only through the abstract universality of disease. On the other hand, the man of madness communicates with society only by the intermediary of an equally abstract reason, which is order, physical and moral constraint, the anonymous pressure of the group, the requirements of conformity. As for a common language, there is no such thing, or rather, there is no such thing any longer. The constitution of madness as a mental illness at the end of the 18th century affords the evidence of a broken dialogue. It posits the separation as already effected, and it thrusts into oblivion all those stammered, imperfect words without fixed syntax in which the exchange between madness and reason was made. The language of psychiatry, which is a monologue of reason about madness, has been established only on the basis of such a silence. End of quote. There is also an important practical aspect linked to that historical argument. By pointing out the contingent nature of what a society characterizes as insane, Foucault also puts the reader on the road to appreciate madness, to reevaluate mental illness. In the conclusion of his book, the author refers several times to a familiar list of poets and artists who fell victim to mental illness. Think of Friedrich Hölderlin, think of the French writer Gérard de Nerval, think of Vincent van Gogh, think of Antonin Artaud, the surrealist writer and poet. Their life and work clearly has a special value to the historian Foucault. It is the only form of insanity in our society that has not been encapsulated by psychiatry. These authors restored the communication between normal people and madness. Foucault's book ushered in a positive reevaluation of what had previously been put away as madness, disorder, or insanity. It became a leading work of the so-called anti-psychiatry movement. During the 1960s and 1970s, this movement aimed at a radical reform of psychiatric care. It was precisely the impossible or deemed impossible communication with the mentally ill that had to be remedied, that had to be restored. Anti-psychiatry stood for the conviction that the treatments from that period, such as medication, such as electroshocks, such as lobotomy, often did more harm than they did good. Well-known supporters of Foucault included psychiatrists and psychotherapists such as Jacques Lacan, Thomas Sass, and Félix Guattari. The movement led to the founding of new organizations and the introduction of new treatments. In England, R.D. Lange and David Cooper founded the Philadelphia Association, and this organization established more than 20 therapeutic communities in England. A good example of such a therapeutic community was Kingsley Hall, where it was an institution for the mentally ill, but there was no hierarchy between staff members and patients. In addition, medication could be taken on a voluntary basis, not a forced basis. Okay, what to do? How does this relate to the arts? That's a question I now want to go deeper into. I've already made an opening when I said that writers and philosophers such as Hölderlin, Nerval, Nietzsche, Artaud restored communication with mental illness. That's a conviction of Foucault, which is expressed at the end of his book, Madness and Civilization. In itself, that may sound rather positive. But, when it stands in a different light, of course, if you consider the psychic suffering that each one of them has experienced. And Foucault himself is aware of this. He also points to many pitfalls. He explains this in a review which he writes of a 1961 book about the German poet Hölderlin. The book is written by Jean Laplanche, who is a former fellow student of Foucault at the École Normale Supérieure. And the book by Laplanche was called Hölderlin et la question du père, Hölderlin and the question of the father. Now, before I go deeper into that, I must tell you a few things about Hölderlin. Hölderlin was a contemporary of the famous poets from the neoclassical period of German literature, Johann Wolfgang von Goethe and Friedrich Schiller, the most famous ones. Yet Hölderlin himself never achieved the same kind of status as Goethe and Schiller. This was partly due to his less accessible writing style. Another factor, however, was that the young poet experienced a severe mental crisis between 1802 and 1807. After his collapse, Hölderlin continued to live for 36 years, but it was impossible for anyone to have a coherent conversation with him. The only thing he wrote were childishly simple poems. Jean Laplanche, the author of the book reviewed by Foucault, was a young French psychiatrist who paid extensive attention to the young Hölderlin's relationship with his father figures. One of these was Friedrich Schiller. Hölderlin felt, according to Laplanche, that he could never live up to what was expected from him, or what he thought these father figures, such as Schiller, expected from him. According to Laplanche, it was these feelings of inadequacy in Hölderlin that were at the basis of both his mental collapse and the complexity of his later poetry. For Foucault, the analysis by Laplanche is unjustified. It's too simplistic. It's an unjustified reduction of Hölderlin's oeuvre, of his work, to the facts of his life. It is too easy. It's too easy to explain the poetic work from the biography. The poems, Foucault says, then become like the carriers of a secret truth, so to say, and the pathological episodes in the life of Hölderlin are transformed, as it were, into the concluding part of the work. Life and work are confused. The basis for such an approach is the belief that in order to know what the poems really mean, you have to look at the moment when the writer sinks into madness. That which cannot be expressed by the poems is brought to light by the disorder of the poet. Foucault himself distances himself from such attempts at psychobiography, as he calls it. On the contrary, he proposes an approach that acknowledges Hölderlin's work as a road that leads to the end of language itself. And you can see this for yourself, I think, if you read some of the poetry, especially the later poetry of Friedrich Hölderlin. The poems open a space, according to Foucault, and I will now quote, where the schizophrenic being is realized to its full extent. That's how Foucault puts it, end of quote. I will quote it again because I think it's an important phrase. The poems open a space where the schizophrenic being is realized to its full extent, end of quote. So the work is not reduced to a symptom in Foucault's approach. It's also being recharged. It's charged with a new power because it now means the possible beginning of a cure for madness. Okay, that's it for today. Many thanks for listening to this podcast on Michel Foucault. Do not forget to read the accompanying chapter in the book, and please do the test, which you will find online. Thank you.